Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends and neighbors. Welcome to today's episode of the Bill Press Pod. What a great country we live in. Every 4 years, we choose our leaders, and then 4 years later, we do it all over again. If we like them, we keep them. If we don't, we throw them out. Well, that's the way it used to work, but not this time. Even though Joe Biden won the election big time, more votes than any other presidential candidate in history, Donald Trump still refuses to concede. And as the Washington Post discovered in a shocking survey, out of 249 Republicans in Congress, only 27 are willing to admit that Biden won. 220 say the election's still undecided, and two of them insist that Trump, not Biden, won. How did we get into this mess? And more importantly, how do we get out of it? Does our democracy survive? Well, today, for some insights and answers, we turn to Ron Brownstein, whom I believe is one of the smartest political historians and strategists in the country. You see him often on television, you read him in The Atlantic. Ron Brownstein's a senior political analyst for CNN and editorial director for Atlantic Media. Ron joined us from his home in Los Angeles. Ron Brownstein, good to catch up with you again, and thanks for joining us here on the Bill Press Pod.
Bill, always good to talk to you.
Thank you. So look, Ron, you and I have been around this a long time, this American politics, but we're going through or suffering through two strange political scenarios I don't think we've ever seen before. We've got a president of the United States who a month later still refuses to accept the results of the election, and a Republican Party, which for the most part is unwilling, the members to do anything, the leaders to do anything to criticize the president for that. They won't even recognize the president-elect. Have we ever seen anything like this before?
No, I don't think anybody's seen anything like this before, it is both shocking and not, right? I mean, it's obviously shocking that an election that was decided by 7 million votes, in which courts around the country have laughed out of the courtroom the accusations of fraud from the Trump campaign, which, you know, appear increasingly unhinged. It is, on the one hand, shocking that so few congressional Republicans have been essentially willing to acknowledge that the sky is blue and that Joe Biden won. But on the other hand, it's not shocking because it follows 4 years in which the congressional Republicans have followed Trump deeper and deeper into the water of violating democratic norms and traditions. I mean, this is the same party that found nothing to complain about when he openly tried to extort the government of Ukraine to manufacture dirt on his opponent and didn't really raise a peep, or still to this point have not raised a peep, as he's become the first president ever to try to tilt the census to the advantage of one party or weaponize the Postal Service. You know, we are focused so much on the unique transgressive nature of Trump himself, but what's happening is much bigger and broader than him, and I don't think we have a precedent for it in American politics for the way that the Republican Party is showing itself willing to run through the rules of small d democracy in order to hold power.
Right. You know, I know you recently wrote about this, and I had seen the parallel too. There was one other time there was a Republican who was making wild, unfounded charges, and the Republican Party, with the sole exception maybe of Margaret Chase Smith, we're talking about the McCarthy era.
Right.
Tell us about that.
I wrote about that this week. I think that what Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy and the Republican leaders are doing now in abetting and enabling these poisonous conspiracy theories from Trump, which are having real world consequences that we can talk about in a minute, is comparable and may even be more abject than the way the Republican leadership in the early 1950s surrendered to Joe McCarthy. Robert Taft, who was the Mitch McConnell of his day, the Senate Republican leader, Mr. Republican, multiple time candidate for the GOP presidential nomination, you know, privately, he acknowledged from the beginning that McCarthy's charges of communist infiltration, a conspiracy so immense, in McCarthy's phrase, were wild and unsubstantiated and damaging. But he saw them as kind of a tactical weapon against the Truman administration, which is when all of this started. And he was willing to go along with it, as were the vast majority of Republicans. There were about six or seven who joined Margaret Chase Smith on the floor to condemn McCarthy early on. She was a first-term Republican senator from Maine, but most of the party went along because they thought, A, that he was helping them against Democrats, and B, they were scared of him. Now, what does that sound like? You know, that could easily be applied to today. Of course, when Eisenhower came in as a Republican president, McCarthy didn't stop. He kept going. And then you saw broader concern. And finally, McCarthy kind of immolated himself in the Army McCarthy hearings, where Joseph Welch said, "At long last, sir, have you no decency?" But it took a very long time. And even at the very bitter end, when the final censure of McCarthy was voted on in 1954, only half the Senate Republicans voted to censure him. I think what we're seeing now, history will regard as at least as bad, in the sense that there were probably more Republicans who stood up to McCarthy by the end than are standing up to Trump by the end. But Mitch McConnell is certainly, I think, going to stand next to Taft in history as someone who, you know, when the chips were really down, put short-term partisan interest over the long-term interest of the country. And you have to ask yourself, does all of this drain away once Trump leaves the stage? Or is there something larger happening that is going to be changing our politics through the next decade, through the 2020s?
Well, that's a big question, I guess, is one of the big questions. I mean, does Trumpism survive? And is Trumpism the Republican Party?
I think, I don't, you know, obviously we don't know for sure, but there is a self-fulfilling dynamic in changes like this. You know, Trumpism defined as kind of an ethno-nationalist appeal to racial resentment and anti-elite sentiment with an authoritarian bent. Has an audience, as we have seen. It has a bigger audience than I think most people expected in this election. We can talk about the different ways of the measuring that audience. But what it does, what it clearly did, was drive away a lot of white-collar, college-educated, center-right suburban voters who probably voted mostly Republican in the past, mostly primarily on economic issues. They, you know, lower taxes, less regulation, all of that. They could not abide many aspects of Trumpism, the volatility, the vulgarity, the open racism. So once they leave the Republican coalition, what's left behind? What's left behind is Trumpier. It is more non-urban, non-college, evangelical. And so you have to ask yourself, what would be the electoral basis for a run against Trumpism for the 2024 nomination, even if he doesn't run, you know? And obviously, there are very different opinions about whether he can retain his influence or whether it will fade. I actually think he can retain a lot of influence. But even if he is not personally on the ballot, the voters who are the most resistant to Trump's definition of the party, if Biden plays his cards well, they're going to be, you know, thinking of themselves more as Democrats over time. And so there's a possibility this is a self-fulfilling prophecy, in the party. And also, let's face it, there hasn't been a lot of profiles in Courage or pushback against, right? Who is the standard bearer around which you would now organize, other than Mitt Romney, a kind of resistance to Trumpism? And we see it again in this post-election period. The fact that so few Republicans can say the obvious, that Biden won this election, there was certainly not massive fraud on a scale big enough or any scale. The fact that they can't even say that shows, I think, how hard it's going to be to change direction.
Right. Isn't it stunning that we now consider as a profile in Courage the fact that someone would simply say, Biden won.
Yes. Yes, it is. And, you know, you don't get here in a day, right, Bill? I mean, you don't get here in a day, and you don't get here without the complicity of the party. I mean, this has been step by step by step. Trump has taken the measure of the Republican Party, and he has recognized that he can lead them another 10 feet away from shore each time, and they will be afraid, really, or willing to go, afraid to confront him, or willing, you know, affirmatively willing to go along with him. You know, I find myself thinking of the counterfactual quite a bit. If Trump had been able to find some Republican judges and or some Republican legislators who are willing to clearly subvert the will of the voters in their state,
right,
and find some reason to grant him the Electoral College votes from Wisconsin or Pennsylvania or Michigan, would Mitch McConnell or Marco Rubio or Rick Scott raise the peep? Or would they have been perfectly willing to steal the election, knowing that it was being stolen, if they thought that Trump could get away with it? And I think their behavior since the election raises a very serious question about whether they would have stood up in any way for small d democracy if Trump could have figured out a way to steal this election, even if everybody recognized that was what was happening.
Right. I don't think there's any doubt the answer to that question. So, Ron, you study American, the demographics, and get dig into it. You know, we've done a lot of stuff at CNN together, more than anybody I know. What does it say about the American electorate when, yeah, Joe Biden got 80 million votes, I'm rounding off here, right? But Donald Trump got 72. I mean,
yeah. Yes. Well, I think the overriding lesson of this election is that we are barely one country at this point. That red America is so alienated from almost everything that is happening in blue America, and that what blue America's vision of what America should be, that it is willing to accept a vessel as flawed as Trump, largely because he promises to stand up to all of that, you know, that he is the human wall against all of the changes that they don't like. You know, he is a candidate, you know, he's a candidate who, you know, as we said, volatile, vulgar, erratic, people being fired left and right, scandal constantly, corruption accusations, over 200,000 people dead, through kind of either in some combination of indifference and incompetence on the pandemic. And yet, you know, he wins 25 states twice. As you say, he wins over 70 million votes. Biden, worth talking about more, wins 223 House districts or so, give or take one or two, which is more than Obama or Clinton did in 16 and 12 while winning the popular vote, but which is not a huge number when you're winning by 7 million. And what that says to me is that inside Red America, the alienation from and the resistance to the democratic vision of what America is becoming and needs to be is so deep that even all of the flaws and demerits of Trump couldn't really shake it. And even with Scranton Joe, middle-class Joe on the other side, you know, I mean, Biden did a little better in some of the mid-sized industrial parts of the country. He did a little, obviously, Erie, Scranton, Green Bay, right. But it really was not a big change, and certainly not as big as they were once hoping. The big change was inside of the large metros. He won 91 of the 100 largest counties in America, even more than Clinton did. But I think we see this division being so profound that voters were willing to accept all of Trump's obvious flaws because they saw him as their weapon against all of the changes in American life. You know, in 2012, I wrote that our politics now divide between a coalition of transformation and a coalition of restoration. And the Democratic coalition are the places and the people who are most comfortable with the way the country is changing demographically, mm-hmm. culturally, and economically. The Republicans mobilize the voters who are least comfortable with that. And that includes a fair number of non-white voters, as we saw in this election. Yeah. And I think that basic fault line is more deeper and more perilous than ever.
By the way, I'm just curious. Do you think that any of the other Democratic candidates in the primary could have fared better than Biden? Or as far as the Democratic Party goes, did they end up with the strongest and the best candidate?
Short answer is I believe he's the only one who could have won. I mean, if you look at this result,
yeah,
The fact that he barely won Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, middle class Joe, 77-year-old white guy, it's really hard for me to see how Kamala Harris or Julian Castro or Pete Buttigieg or Bernie Sanders, or really any of them, would have won those states. Now, you know, eventually, and we saw the beginnings of this transformation in this election, the Democrats, if they can start winning the Sunbelt states more regularly, Georgia and Arizona crossing the line this time, North Carolina, again, very close, but
very close.
Disappointing for Democrats, they will be less hostage to their ability to win enough blue-collar whites in the Rust Belt to get to 270. But they're not there yet. I mean, they did have to, you know, and I don't think anybody else could have made this work. I'm not even sure anybody else can make this work in 2024. I mean, you know, you can project it out forward and say, okay, well, 8 more years of demographic change, non-college whites are declining 2 points as a share of eligible voters every 4 years. You know, the under 18 population is majority non-white. Most of the people aging into the election will be non-white. College whites are slightly growing. You can say, well, okay, well, maybe in 8 years you can do this with a coalition that is more Sunbelt based, more diversity based. But it's probably, the likelihood is that in 2024, and certainly in the Senate and the House, you're going to have to compete at least as well as Biden did, and probably a little better, maybe not the presidential, but in the House, for those non-college whites. And who else out there is it? Sherrod Brown, maybe. I mean, Sherrod Brown didn't run. I could imagine him doing as well as Biden did, but I think Democrats are caught in between their past and their future to some extent. Until the future snaps into place in the Sun Belt and you can reliably win Georgia, Arizona, maybe North Carolina, and maybe eventually Texas, about which there were some positive signs along with the negatives. Until you can do that, you need somebody who can perform credibly among blue-collar whites in the Rust Belt. And the list of Democrats who can do that is probably pretty short.
One other change that you've written about in terms of the Republican Party base is the declining number of evangelicals, I guess we call, white Protestant.
Right.
That,
right.
Which is,
well, they're declining in the society and maintaining their presence in the Republican coalition. And, you know, I sometimes say that the two parties now offer not only different visions of America, but different versions of America. I mean, the Republican Party is in many ways, you know, the America of 20 and 30 years ago. And the Democratic Party is in many ways in the America of 15 years from now. And a good example is religion. White Christians were a majority, all white Christians, evangelicals, mainline Protestants, Catholics, other Christian faiths. White Christians were a majority of the country's population for as long as there's been a country, until about 2010, 2011, 2012. Somewhere in there, in the General Social Survey, it fell under 50%. And right now, white Christians are down to roughly 42, depending on the data source, 41, 42, 43% of the country. That's it. White Christians are only a little over 2/5 of the country. They are still 2/3 of all Republicans. Okay. The last time that was true for the whole country was like 1998 or 1997. And you can do the same thing, by the way, with race, with gun ownership, people who are working in manufacturing and agriculture and energy extraction. In all of these ways, the Republican Party coalition reflects kind of mid to late 20th century America. Meanwhile, in the Democratic coalition now is about 1/3 white Christians, 1/3 non-white Christians, and 1/3 people who either don't ascribe to any religious faith or belong to a non-Christian faith. And that, you know, that's probably what America is going to be in like 2034. Or 2035. Mm-hmm. And again, the same thing with the diversity. I mean, you know, Joe Biden, I'm sure Biden got about 44% of his votes from non-whites. You know, the electorate will be that in, you know, 2032 or 2036. And so it really is, you know, we have sorted out into one coalition that kind of has 1 foot in the future, one coalition that kind of really has 2 feet in the past. And neither one of them has a durable advantage over the other in the distribution of power. Although Democrats have now, you know, the Democratic coalition is larger. There's no question about it at this point. They've won 7 out of 8 popular vote No party, as you may know, has ever done that since the formation of the modern party system. No party's ever won 7 out of 8, not even Republicans in the aftermath of Lincoln, not Democrats in the FDR Truman. The best anybody's ever done is 6 out of 8 or 7 out of 9. And Democrats have now done 7 out of 8. And, you know, you would certainly bet on them if it goes decently for Biden to make it 8 out of 9, whether or not they win the Electoral College. So they have a larger coalition, but the way it's distributed and the way the demographic change has not reached so many of those smaller plains and mountain states, you know, and not to mention in the House, has not extended beyond the imaginary beltways around every major metro. It leaves them competing on a pretty narrow terrain. And as much as the Democrats are benefiting from the demographic change, and as much as the Republicans have to fear what's happening in Metro America, unless someone's going to change the Constitution, Democrats got to figure out a way to win a few more small town and rural votes, I think. I mean, you know, I'm interested in really your thought about that, because, you know, they've gone through a few cycles now of looking for ways to do that. It's been almost a complete wipeout. Now, that may be because Trump is so uniquely capable of touching the cultural buttons of small town America and appealing to their fear of being eclipsed and marginalized by what's happening in the diverse cities. But, you know, we've had two elections in a row where Democrats could not win a single Senate seat in a state that Trump carried, and in which their ability to win House seats beyond kind of the metro core has been very limited.
Right. You know, on that point, which is where I really wanted to get to next, let's just pause here for a quick break, and then we will be right back on today's edition of the Bill Press Pod. Today's podcast with Ron Brownstein, brought to you by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. Yes, those good members of the UFCW under President Mark Perrone. Next time you shop at Macy's, say thank you to your UFCW member who checks you out. Same next time you shop at Safeway. They're the frontline workers at our retail stores and grocery stores that serve us even during these pandemic days. We salute them. Thank them for their good work and thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod. Check out their website at ufcw.org.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget. Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we're back with Ron Brownstein, a contributor to CNN from Atlantic Magazine and author of a new book coming out in March, Ron,
about Rock Me on the Water.
Rock Me on the Water.
Yes.
All about L.A. in the early 70s. Huh?
Yeah.
All right. Great. Looking for. So what happened in the Senate? I mean, we were maybe you and I weren't predicting, but a lot of people were predicting a blue wave in late October, right? That definitely Democrats were going to pick up maybe 10, 15 seats in the House, and they were going to take back control of the Senate. What went wrong? Was it this inability to reach into the rural and the non-urban, non-big city areas?
It really was party-wide, Bill. It was not the Senate candidates, I don't think, or the House candidates, I don't think. It was the inability of Democrats to conquer new terrain. And what I mean by that is the long-term trend in the Senate, as you know, is that it is getting harder for either side to win Senate seats in states that usually vote the other way for president. 2008, there were still six senators who won election in states that voted the other way for McCain, Democrats who won in states that voted for McCain, or Republican, I think Susan Collins and was the only one in that election who won in states that voted for Obama. By the time we got to 2016, first time ever in American history, every single Senate race went the same way as the presidential race in that state. So to some extent, and I ended up writing this on Election Day, my piece on Election Day was that the Democrats' chances of winning the Senate were dwindling unless Biden himself was going to win some of these key states, North Carolina, Iowa, and Georgia, because what we saw in the late polling after earlier in the summer and fall, there was a fair amount of split ticket preferences being expressed in the polling. Like Cal Cunningham was running ahead of Biden in North Carolina, and Teresa Greenfield was running ahead of Biden in Iowa. I wrote on Election Day, and I had collected a whole bunch of polling data that was beginning to collapse, and the presidential vote and the Senate vote, just as in 2016, were converging. And so it turned out in the end that Susan Collins, to this point, was the only senator in either party in either of the last two presidential elections who won a state that their presidential candidate did not carry. In fact, if you look kind of at it a little more broadly, there were 20 states that voted against Trump in both of his campaigns. Democrats now have 39 of their 40 Senate seats, every one but Collins. There were 25 states that voted for Trump both times. And Republicans now have 47 of their 50 Senate seats, which every one of them have Sherrod Brown, Tester, and Joe Manchin, which obviously leaves Democrats in a very difficult position in the Senate, because even though they've won the popular vote 7 out of 8, Republicans have won more states. Mm-hmm. And if the presidential is lining up with the Senate, it makes it very tough. So I would say that, essentially what happened in the Senate was it reverted to what is becoming the modern pattern. And Biden wasn't able to push out into quite enough places. Obviously, he won Arizona and Kelly did. He won Colorado and that helped Hickenlooper. But he didn't win Iowa and he didn't win North Carolina. He did win Georgia. And we'll see how that goes. The House, to a surprising extent, is pretty much the same story. Like in the end, Joe Biden, I think I wrote a piece, the best estimates now are that he won somewhere around 223 House districts. Now that is better than Clinton did. She won 209, I think, and Obama, no, she won 205, and Obama in 2012 won 209 while winning the popular vote. They lost most House districts. Biden did better, and that reflects the Democrats' expanding reach into suburbs, white-collar suburban districts around the country. But 223 is not a big number. And in the end, yes, there will be about 10 or 11 Republicans who won in districts that Biden did, like Nebraska 2, it looks like Texas 24, some of the Orange County seats. But there are also about 10 or 11 Republicans, I'm sorry, 10 or 11 Democrats who won in seats that Trump did. Mm-hmm. So it really isn't kind of comparative crossover that decided it. It's the fact that even in a 7 million vote election victory, Biden was only able to win 223 House seats. And what didn't happen, what happened in the House was, I think, pretty clear, is that in 2018, we saw a big suburban wave for the Democrats, and it not only rolled through places where they had been strong before, like Philadelphia or Northern Virginia or New Jersey, it extended, right? It reached Richmond and Dallas and Houston and Atlanta. And what Democrats thought was that that was going to keep going in this election. I mean, I don't know how many of the seats they lost they were surprised at losing. I mean, these are very Trumpy districts, most of them, that were going to be hard to hold with him on the ballot. But they thought they would offset them because they thought there would be new suburban seats that were even more Republican than the ones they won in 2018 that would fall this time. Places like Chip Roy's district, you know, between Austin and San Antonio, or Missouri, St. Louis suburbs, or Indianapolis suburbs. That didn't happen. Biden didn't win the seats, and Democrats didn't win the seats. So I kind of go back to my point about the high water mark. Yes, 7 million vote win, 223 seats in the House. But, you know, it wasn't like the wave kept going into a lot of new terrain at the presidential level to some extent. Gwinnett and Cobb, yeah, and they won that House seat. But, you know, Biden ended up not winning Indiana 5, and he ended up not winning Missouri 2. And Democrats thought he was going to win all of those and that they would win as a result.
Were you surprised? You referenced it a little bit earlier. Were you surprised that Trump actually picked up and improved in some Latino districts, particularly?
Yes. I think I was. I don't think, you know, I don't think I was surprised about Florida. Let me leave that aside. I mean, South Florida is its own beast. and, you know, it's its own thing. And the socialism arguments and all of that was very effective. But it seemed, you know, the Rio Grande Valley was, you know, catastrophic for Democrats.
Yeah.
And I think there's evidence, you know, from the precinct level stuff that Trump may have improved slightly in a lot of places among Hispanics. Now, Arizona, Nevada stayed pretty strong. Black voters, too, he did a little better. Democrats, I think, really have to examine what happened. I offer two thoughts on that. One is that if you look, and I mentioned this in a story, if you look at polling about values, okay, there's a bigger share of Black and Hispanic voters who express the same kind of anxieties as non-college whites about changing gender roles and changing cultural mores, then vote for Republicans. I mean, there is an audience. I mean, there's an audience among Black and Hispanic men for some of Trump's implicit and explicit kind of appeals to traditional gender, you know, solidarity. And there is an audience among which, you know, was kind of suppressed for a while, but I think Trump activated there's a share of the African-American community that isn't so happy about large scale immigration. I mean, that was something we experienced in California in the 90s.
Absolutely.
And you know, a majority of Black voters voted for Prop 187, according to the exit poll at the time. So he had an audience for some of his cultural argument. And then second, I think he had an audience for reopening the economy no matter what in some of these minority communities, even though they are being ravaged the most by coronavirus. Obviously, they're being hurt. Now, having said all this, he seemed to improve his share among both Black and especially Hispanic voters. On the other hand, he inspired so many people to come out and vote against him that his net deficit of votes in many of these places was greater. Right. Mm-hmm. So you can get a bigger share. You know, if you go from 11 to 12% of Black voters and Black voters go from 10,000 to 20,000, you lose more, you lose them by a bigger net total. And that piece of the equation you can't forget as well. I think there is obviously a limit to how far the Republican Party can go into building a beachhead in those communities while embracing as overt an appeal to white racial resentment as Trump does. But it does suggest that if you dial that back, if you can find a way to dial that back, some of your other cultural arguments might find an audience and you can kind of chip away at the overwhelming Democratic numbers. I was surprised by the Asian American numbers, too. I mean, Trump did better among all three, Hispanics, Black and Asian Americans. Now, again, more turnout, bigger net deficit, but a higher share.
Back in those days when you and I were both active in California politics, we always considered the Latino vote, it was a conservative vote. It was a largely Republican vote until Prop 187.
Yeah, yeah.
And for the very reasons you articulated.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, and a lot of cultural conservatism. And look, I mean,
small businesses, family oriented, Catholic.
The evangelical side of the Latino community. Texas was kind of interesting because, I mean, obviously Democrats were very disappointed by how Texas fell out. Biden ended up losing by 6. five or six. They didn't win the state house. They didn't win any of their targeted house districts. I mean, kind of stunning that they could not win. And then they lost Will Hurd's district again. But they significantly improved in the metros. I mean, they did do a lot better in Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, and Austin, and even the inner suburbs of those places like Collin and Denton and Williamson and Hayes. And it does say that if you can solve your problem in the Rio Grande Valley, which should be solvable, I mean, if Biden puts effort into it, you can bring that into play. And again, mm-hmm. to my point from when we started, you know, in the long run, I coined the phrase the blue wall in 2009, right? There's a national journal, cover, and there's a story I wrote, and the lead is call it the blue wall. So I as the father of the blue wall, I can say that Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin were always the most loosely attached. They were the least like the other states in terms of their demography, their religious background. And I don't think we will ever get to a point again where Democrats can rely on those states. They might win them. I'm not saying mm-hmm. they're always going to lose them, but it's not like they're not California, Washington, and Oregon, or New York, right. Massachusetts, and Connecticut. And given that, the inexorable necessity is to figure out ways to win more of everything. Electoral college votes, Senate seats, House seats across the Sun Belt. And right. I think that is the challenge of the 2020s for the Democrats.
All right, Rob, we can't let you go before I ask you just a little bit about what we've seen so far in the transition for the last month of Joe Biden. How do you think Joe Biden's handling the transition? What do his cabinet appointments that we've seen so far tell us about what we can expect from a Biden administration?
I don't think we have a pudding yet. I mean, I think I think his appointments, the first round of appointments in the White House and Tony Blinken as Secretary of State, he's 77 years old and he's comfortable with who he's comfortable with, and I think that was the initial round. And then I think he's kind of been reacting to that a little bit, pressure for more diversity in both gender and race. The all-female White House communications team. Somebody said to me, it still feels a little like the guys make the product and we're supposed to sell the product. I thought that was an interesting observation. But I do think it. Look, he has a difficult job of managing this coalition. Particularly because the margins are so narrow in Congress. I mean, you have the left who wants things and the center who is very spooked, as you can imagine, as you would be. If that many of the Democrats in Trump districts lost in 2020, they're going to be careful about what they vote for in the next 2 years. So he's got this kind of internal tension and then this external reality that he's got like a 4-seat majority in the House, maybe 5, and at best a 50-50 Senate. And I think the appointments kind of reflect, I wouldn't say uncertainty, but not putting all of your chips on one dice about how to handle that. I mean, he's got some people who are more acceptable to the left. He's got some people who are more acceptable to the center. He's so far kept out the folks that the left is most mobilized against. I feel like, as I said, the pudding hasn't formed, or he's keeping his options open. Like, I don't think he's like he's given us a pure signal of where he's going. And I think it's more like he's keeping his options open to go in different directions, and maybe to go in different directions at once.
Yeah, indeed. It's going to be fun. It's always fun to watch. It's no matter how bad it gets, it's always fun to watch and to be part of. And Ron Brownstein, you are one of the best observers of the American politics that I know, and it's so good of you to give us some time today. We look forward to talking to you again when your book comes out.
Oh, that'd be great, Bill. And you're in the book. You're in the book in Jerry Brown's orbit in 1974. What were you doing? Office of Policy.
Office of Planning and Research.
Office of Planning and Research.
Right, director. Right. And by the way, Ron, I am still in Jerry Brown's orbit.
There you go. That's how we all in some way.
Exactly. Right. Okay. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you, Bill.
It's good to see you. And that's it for today's podcast with Ron Brownstein from CNN and from The Atlantic. And by the way, on the episode notes for today's podcast, we'll provide a link to some of Ron's recent articles for The Atlantic and for CNN. Thank you again for listening. And now, before we go, we remind you one more time, if you haven't already done so, subscribe to the Bill Press Pod, please. Just wherever you're listening to this podcast, pull up the Bill Press Pod, click on subscribe, and you are in. And then one other thing, stay strong, stay safe, stay sane until we see you on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.